From their studio in the Feeding Arizona building in Youngtown, Arizona, it's the Boomer and the Babe Show with Pete Peters and Deborah Brown. Join Pete and Deborah and their guests as they give voice to 78 million baby boomers from coast to coast and border to border. Now here are the Boomer and the Babe, Pete Peters and Deborah Brown.
Yes, and good morning on the West Coast, good afternoon on the East Coast. This is the Boomer the Babe Show. It's Friday, September 14th, 2012, and we're broadcasting from our studios, actually in Sun City, Arizona. We got to change that intro a little bit. And we're going to have an interesting hour or so today with two vascular surgeons, doctors. One is going to be talking to us today about PAD, which is peripheral artery disease, and the other one is going to be talking to us about abdominal aortic aneurysm. So kind of settle in and buckle down, and if you ever had any questions about why you have a pain in your leg or you have a pain in your gut or whatever the case might be, and certain symptoms occur, we'll discuss a little bit of that, and we're going to get into the show right away with, first of all, with Dr. Louis Messina. He's the MD, Chief of Division of Vascular and Endovascular Surgery at University of Massachusetts Memorial Healthcare, and Vice Chair for Research in the DARPA Department of Surgery. He's a professor of surgery at the University of Massachusetts Medical School, and he maintains clinical interests in carotid and lower extremity arterial occlusive disease, complex aortic and renal I'm screwing up these things, doctor. I'm terribly sorry. And thoracic outlet syndrome and pediatric vascular reconstruction. Boy, you do a lot of things. Welcome to the Boomer the Babe Show, Dr. Louis Messina.
Well, thank you very much, Pete.
I'm sorry I butchered the medical terminology so badly. But
no, those are unusual. Some of those are rare and unusual terms you've probably never even seen before. So
well, the last time I saw him was when I took him off the computer 10 minutes ago. Tell me a little bit, if Deborah were with us, but she's not here today. Tell me a little bit, and our listeners a little bit about your background in a minute or two, and how did you get interested and involved in your specialty today? Then we're going to get into what it is that you actually specialize in.
All right. Well, you know, in terms of background, I guess I developed interest while a college student. I did some research one summer, and it just happened to be with a vascular surgeon, and I never knew anything about the disease, and did a research project that ended up getting published, and so that's what sparked my interest. I went to medical school at State University of New York Downstate Medical Center, which is in Brooklyn, New York, where I grew up. I did 5 years of general surgery training at the University of California, San Francisco, and then I did 2 years of research there as well in the Cardiovascular Research Institute. And then finally, I did training at University of California, San Francisco in vascular disease. After I finished my training, my first faculty position was at the University of Michigan for approximately 10 years. And then I was became chief of vascular surgery at UCSF, and then subsequently now have moved here. And I think you describe I have a broad practice in vascular disease. But I also do bench research and actually study what's referred to as the mechanisms by which collateral arteries enlarge. And collateral arteries are these pre-existing arteries we're all born with. And when the major artery blocks, the blood flow goes through the collateral artery. And it doesn't completely make up for the lost blood flow, but it can be enough to save the leg. And we don't really understand why these arteries enlarge more in some people than in others, and it's turned out to be a very interesting story. So
sure.
There's the background, short background.
So we're going to discuss with you, and then Dr. Schanzer is going to be on, and we're going to discuss the aortic issues. We're going to discuss PAD, peripheral artery disease. Well, we've established so far that it is indeed PAD, short for peripheral artery disease. But what is it? I mean, what happens there?
Well, the term, you know, refers to blockages of arteries, and the term peripheral means arteries other than those in the heart. So any artery in the leg, in the neck, that go to the brain, in the abdomen, that supply blood flow to the kidneys and intestines, any of those arteries can become blocked with arteriosclerosis, you know, the same condition that affects the arteries in the heart, the coronary arteries, and it's that disease process that then leads to blockage of a coronary artery and then a heart attack. And so, you know, you can have the same process occur in peripheral arteries. Most of the time when this term is used, and this is Peripheral Arterial Disease Awareness Month, it's really about blockages of the arteries of the legs, because that's the most common site. And it's, you know, widely considered the most underdiagnosed and undertreated of any of the cardiovascular diseases. And part of that is that, you know, it's becoming more common with the population as it's aging. And there's a general lack of familiarity with the disease by some primary care doctors.
So, is this something that we see all this stuff and all these commercials on television for various drugs and so on and so forth? Is this what they refer to as restless leg syndrome?
That's a good question. It does not cause that. And many people who have that are referred to see whether it's caused by PAD, and it doesn't. And then many people who have blockages in their legs, they get the restless leg syndrome at night, and they wonder, is it related? And the restless leg is a different condition. That's more related to just the muscle and the nerves of the leg. This is a condition that is caused by blockages of the artery. That means then there is reduced blood flow to the legs, and less oxygen delivery. And, you know, what's interesting is that it's a pretty common disease. In other words, it affects about 8 to 10 million Americans. It affects 12 to 20% of people over 65. In the age group 70 to 80, about 18 to 20% of people will have it.
Wow.
But the problem is about only 20% have symptoms. So most people who have the condition don't know they have it. Now, does it have any significance if it doesn't cause you symptoms? Yes, it does. And the reason is that if you have PAD, you have a 3 or 4-fold higher risk of death from a heart attack, a stroke. And so whenever PAD is identified, now we have studies that show you should be treated with certain medications, which we can discuss, which then can greatly reduce that risk of death from cardiovascular disease.
So I go to my cardiologist, and I go in, and he gives he monitors my situation, because I have AFib, and I'm taking Coumadin or warfarin for that.
Mm-hmm.
And it reminds me, I got to do my self-test here at home today. talk about stream of consciousness stuff. And I go to him, and he's checking my information on my clotting factors, and I go, he checks me out. He may give me an EKG right there in the office to make sure nothing's changed and so on and so forth. It comes, maybe he says, well, it's time for us to do another stress test with you. And he puts that stuff in my system, and then I sit there on that table, and the camera goes around me, and all, you know, all that stuff is. Is at that time when I should also be being checked for PAD?
Well, you know, your cardiologist is certainly very knowledgeable about this condition. But it's very straightforward. You don't need any really sophisticated question and testing, and that's a good question. Really, all primary care doctors are now looking for this condition, and the way you do that is simply by evaluating the presence or absence of pulses. You know you have a pulse in your wrist, or some people feel that pulse in their neck. Well, There are pulses throughout the leg. There are two pulses in the feet, one behind the ankle and one on top of the foot. Those are called the posterior tibial and dorsalis pedis arteries. So it is part of a normal physical exam now to see whether or not those are present or absent. And then there's a very simple test to, you know, determine the degree to which the blood flow to the leg is impaired. And that test is called an ankle brachial index. And it's simply measuring the blood pressure in the arm, which you assume is normal, and the blood pressure in the at the level of the ankle. And they should be the same. Their ratio should be 1. If the blood pressure is 100 in the arm, it should be 100 in the foot or by the ankle. And anything less than a ratio of 0.95 or anything more than a 5% difference is considered abnormal and is almost always associated with some blockage. So you can determine whether or not someone has blockages mostly just by physical exam. You can kind of get a quantitative idea of the extent of the blockage by getting this ankle brachial index. And then whether or not someone has symptoms, you get that by talking to them. And if I just might mention the main, there's two categories of symptoms. The most common is something called intermittent claudication. And that's when people get pain in their legs after walking a short distance that then goes away completely after a few minutes of rest. It can occur in any muscle group area, buttock, thigh, or calf. Most commonly, it's the calf because the most common artery to be blocked in the leg is the artery in the thigh. So if the main artery in the thigh is blocked, the symptoms will be in the calf. Claudication can sometimes occur at 200 meters. Sometimes it can occur at 50 meters and be very, very much affect someone's quality of life. When the blood flow is reduced by more than 60 or 70%, then a condition called critical limb ischemia occurs. And that, is manifested usually in three different ways. Either the person will get continuous pain in the forefoot, especially at night. The pressure in the leg is very low, and just simply elevating it reduces the pressure further. And then the foot will hurt continuously until they put the foot back down on the floor. You also can develop what are called ischemic ulcers, and these are small, rounded ulcers that usually occur on bony prominences of the foot. They're very painful. And then sometimes people get really what's called dry gangrene, or parts of the, usually it's the toes, that the tips of them, the tissue basically dies and a scab forms. On the one hand, when you have the pain when walking intermittent claudication, you're not at that time at risk of losing your leg. That's a condition that affects the quality of your life. It's kind of like angina of the leg. Mm-hmm. The other condition always has to be treated, because if you have what's called the ischemic rest pain, left untreated, the majority of those patients will lose their legs unless something is done to increase blood flow.
So what are the there's just like anything else, I'm imagining there's risk factors that are in for PAD. Some people are more at risk than others. What might some of those be?
Yeah, I think that's a very important question, Pete. They parallel the ones for coronary artery disease, except the relative significance varies. So the most important modifiable risk factor is smoking. People who smoke are 3 times more likely to get blockages in their legs than people who don't. People who smoke and have a reconstruction of some sort, a bypass, that bypass is more at risk of failing. So the most common risk factor that we see is smoking. The second, unfortunately, is diabetes. Diabetics are also two to three times more likely to get blockages in their legs. And, you know, if a diabetic lives long enough, most of them will get blockages. In other words, it'll end up at least, or approximately, one out of every three people with diabetes has peripheral arterial disease. And they get into more problems than other people because of the issues of impaired healing. And then the other risk, so those are the two most common and important risk factors that most predict the risk of this problem. Hypertension is also an important risk factor, and high cholesterol levels is a risk factor. Obesity is as well, and then there's something called hyperhomocysteinemia, and you know that's just that has to do with that's a blood test, and it's not nearly as important as the smoking and the diabetes. So those are the two main risk factors.
Smoking and diabetes. Now, mm-hmm. if somebody has smoked and they're no longer a smoker, I mean they don't even think about smoking anymore. Me, does that risk factor diminish as time goes by, or is the risk factor always there because you did once smoke?
It doesn't diminish. You may be thinking about lung cancer, where it does diminish quite a bit if you stop smoking. It doesn't diminish as much, but it definitely, it really depends on how long you smoke for and what age. Because once the process is started, you know, the atherosclerotic plaque, that, you know, is going to have a natural history or progression. And it'll just progress maybe more rapidly if you continue to smoke, or more rapidly if you have diabetes. So really what I'm trying to say is that it's another very, very important reason not to smoke.
Sure. Any number of reasons not to smoke, as I have learned over the years, since I quit smoking many years ago already, and I'm certainly glad that I did and was able to. Who is at greater risk as far as the people with, you mentioned people with diabetes and so on and so forth, but then also is one nationality more at risk than another? Is one race more at risk than another? Does your, how much does hereditary figure into this?
Yeah, that, also a good question. So, you know, sometimes the way we separate out risk factors, we say there are modifiable risk factors, and smoking, diabetes, hypertension are modifiable, and then there are those that aren't. And the three main ones you've mentioned, gender, genetics, and age. So there have now been 20 genes that have been identified that put a person at increased risk for developing PAD. And likely there are a lot more. So it's really an interaction between a genetic predisposition and then developing a risk factor such as smoking. The older we get, the higher the risk. So that's why I mentioned that people in their 70s, you know, if they're examined for pulses or undergo an ankle brachial index, 18 to 20%, basically one in five, have PAD. So age is a risk factor. Gender, men in general are more at risk than women. And then, as you mentioned, hereditary or genetics. And you know, those are considered the non-modifiable risk factors.
Well, as why is it that men are more at risk than women? I mean, I'm always amazed when I speak to a medical professional and they say, well, one, obviously genetically a woman is more likely to get pregnant than a man. I understand that. But in a particular thing such as PAD, which you think would be an equal opportunity disease, why is it that men have a greater propensity?
It's the same for most of the vascular diseases. First of all, for most cardiovascular disease, coronary disease, as you know, the population ages, increase in obesity, women are certainly get coronary disease. More women die of a heart attack than men. But for PAD, there are more men than women. The primary reason why women are shown in many studies, but not all, to have a lower incidence is simply that, you know, estrogens, female hormones, are protective against the development of arteriosclerosis or blockages of the artery. It's in the same way as your next guest will speak about aneurysms. Aneurysms are more common in men than women, but if women live long enough, they develop as well. These conditions take, you know, 10 to 15 years to develop. So basically, women are protected more than men against all these risk factors while their hormone levels are higher. And as those go down with their aging, then they become at increased risk.
Interesting.
Does that make sense?
Yes, it makes perfect sense. It's a logical progression, I would imagine, and I don't know why I didn't even think of it. Probably because I don't have any medical training. Now talk about genetics. I don't think they were into genetic engineering for things like this, but is there, because their genetics do play a part, is there something that could be done if you identify the person as genetically having a higher risk? Is there something that they could be taught or told or instructed at a much younger age to help prevent it later?
I think that is not the case now in general, except for you know, the mutations or the genetic abnormalities that result in someone's increased tendency to form clots. You know, we use the term thrombosis. That might change their treatment. But I think, you know, you're getting at what will probably be happening within 5, not more than 10 years. You know, the Human Genome Project you know, has now sequenced the whole genome. Well, there's a lot of work going on to make that more rapid and much less expensive. And probably in 5 years, each individual will be able to have their genome studied and mutations identified. And that might allow, you know, more aggressive early, examination and testing for diseases. But if there's going to be that kind of the real area that may impact this could be in the area of stem cell therapy. You know, there are some, whereas the gene therapy trials are not yet having a big impact on very many diseases, there's some evidence early on now that the stem cell trials seem to have an impact on both PAD and heart disease. So I think that's something to look forward to on the treatment side, but I think on the diagnostic side, once we get to the point where everyone's genome gets sequenced, I mean, people are having it done now, except that it costs, you know, a couple of $1,000s. But when the price gets down to about $500, then that might become something that's done every 5 years, and it's, you know, it's too early to speak specifically to what impact that'll have. It will correlate with how rapidly, you know, the various mutations that occur that increase the risk of a condition such as PAD. So one is, you know, technological advances. The other are large studies to identify genes that predispose to certain diseases.
Well, Doctor, we're coming down to the short rows here on our conversation for the day. Is there anything that that we've missed that you would like to make sure that people know about PAD before we say goodbye?
Yeah, there is. As I mentioned, you know, in the beginning, it's probably the most underdiagnosed and undertreated, and you know, and it's present in you know, a significant proportion of people over 65. So studies have shown, certainly in patients with symptoms, but we also believe in people who have, do not have symptoms, that taking simvastatin, it's one of the statins, and taking it even if the cholesterol level is normal, can reduce your risk of death, limb loss, or stroke by 25%. So whenever we detect peripheral arterial disease now, the baseline treatment is to start the person on simvastatin. Aspirin, you know, it's considered an antiplatelet agent, has about an equivalent ability to reduce death from cardiovascular disease. So most people should be on simvastatin and aspirin. Smoking cessation is the cornerstone for anybody who smokes. And it's a real paradox. You know, for patients who have claudication, that is to say pain when walking certain fixed distances, regular exercise programs, and particularly supervised exercise programs, can allow a person to double or even triple their pain-free walking distance. So kind of the cornerstones of treatment are to assess the individual for all the risk factors, make sure they're all optimized. Controlling hypertension also improves outcome. Aspirin, simvastatin, and exercise. Those are the cornerstones. And, you know, if those are implemented early on, that will greatly, greatly reduce the risk of someone becoming in the position to lose their leg.
Well, that's all good information, Doctor. I appreciate, as I said earlier, you're taking the time to be with me today, talking about PAD. And I'm glad, one thing, if nothing else, I'm glad we cleared up that restless leg and PAD are separate entities. I found that very interesting. For some
yes.
reason, in my mind, I thought they were basically interchangeable. And it's interesting to know that they're not. So they would therefore be treated differently as well, I'm going to
yes.
imagine. Very yeah. good. Well, thank you very much, Doctor. I'm going to get to your colleague here now. I can see
okay.
that he's back on the line. So thanks again for spending time with me, Dr. Louis Messina.
You're very welcome, Pete. Thank you for having me on.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. And we're going to play our little commercial set here, and then we're going to be right back with the next doctor talking about aortic aneurysm. So we're having a blood vessel and blood day today, and we're going to be talking to the next doctor here in about 3 minutes.
Boomer the Babe are the publishers of Boomer Series books. Our authors have their own shows on the Boomer the Babe Network. We encourage you to listen. Ron Naraki, author of the forthcoming book, The Ten Commandments of Investing, is the host of Wealth DNA, a financial show about real estate investment. Learn how to build and manage your portfolio. Ron hosts the show, and he always has good information to pass along, as do his guests. Listen to Wealth DNA on the second and fourth Monday of the month at 8 a.m. Arizona time. Tom Liggering's another Boomer Series author. His book, Success or Failure, The Choice is Yours, is the basis of the show he does with his broadcast partner, Dr. Terry Munther. Listen to Success or Failure with Tom and Terry on the fourth Wednesday of every month at 9 a.m. Arizona time. Learn how you can maximize your performance in business and in life. The methods you employ can either help or hinder. The choice is yours.
Hey folks, John Bloom here. When I'm not broadcasting for the Cardinals or Suns, I've been spending the last couple of years with my friends building the fastest growing online golf community in the great state of Arizona. Before you book your next round of golf here, go see what golfers just like you are saying about the courses you want to play at golfmix.com. You'll get the most authentic feedback from golfers giving you information you need before you spend the money you've earned. While you're there, write a review of the last course you played and get $10 off your next purchase at Vans Golf Shops. And enter into the Greenskeeper of the Year contest for a chance to win a foursome at the home of the Waste Management Phoenix Open, the stadium course at TPC Scottsdale. Please join us for the next Golf Mixer, Saturday, October 6th at the Raven Golf Club in Verado, and play a hole with PGA Tour winner Aaron Overholser and World Long Drive champion Brian Pavlett. You can find details on golf mixers, tournaments, charity events, junior golf, and more on our statewide golf events calendar. Just check out Golf Mix, Arizona's leading golf course review site and mobile app. What are you waiting for? At golfmix.com.
The Boomer and the Babe are proud to be affiliated with Valley View Community Food Bank, where the food is always free. Valley View is now serving Phoenix from their new 36,000 square foot location at West Peoria and 107th Avenue in Sun City, Arizona. The new location houses the food bank, Feeding Arizona, and the Valley View Thrift Store. Feeding Arizona delivers food to other food banks and food pantries that are in need. If you're looking for a 501c3 to support, go to valleyviewcommunityfoodbank.com. All donations are welcome, be it food, money, or volunteer hours. No donation is too small. Get a hold of Jesse Ramirez, founder and director, and say, "I want to help." Valley View Community Food Bank, where the food is always free.
And we are back. This is the Boomer the Babe Show. It's Friday, September 14th, 2012, and we're going to be speaking now with the second of the two doctors discussing vascular health on today's show, and he is Dr. Andres Schanzer, MD. He is a vascular surgeon at the University of Massachusetts Memorial Medical Center in Worcester, Mass. And Dr. Schanzer has performed the first implantation in the United States of an investigational branched endovascular graft. Boy, I butchered your partner's terms, but I think I got that one right. That's done.
Oh, that was pretty good.
The new branched endograft differs significantly from standard endografts because its unique design allows us to maintain blood flow through vessels originating off the aneurysm. And we're going to find out more about that, I'm sure, in our conversation. Dr. Schanzer, welcome to the Boomer the Babe Show. We're glad you could make it today.
Thanks very much for having me.
Believe me, it's my pleasure. I enjoy talking to the educated, well-spoken medical people, and it makes me think that I missed my calling somewhere. I should have been a doctor, I think. But then again, I get over that real quick too, because I wouldn't want to work the hours you guys work, and I wouldn't want to face the decisions that you have to make sometimes. So, my hat's off to all of the doctors and you two gentlemen today as well.
Thank you.
Why don't we, by way of a little background, give me about a minute or two of your background, where you started. I know you went to school across the country, probably in different locations, if it's anything like many of the other doctors I've spoken to, and please give us some background about Dr. Schanzer and
sure.
anything you want to tell us.
Yeah, so I think in the way of background, I, as you said, kind of have moved around a little bit with my training. I grew up in the New York area and then went up to Boston for college and ultimately started developing an interest in medicine. I'd say when I was a high school student with an interest in biology and then really cemented that down in college where I majored in biology and neurosciences. And then I went back to New York for my medical school training and very quickly realized that I really liked the disease states and also the ability to affect pretty immediate change with surgery. So I found myself attracted to a career in surgery and then went on to do surgical training in general surgery in California and then back to Boston for my vascular surgery training. And then have taken my job here at UMass where I've worked since my final training in vascular surgery here in Worcester, Massachusetts. I have a broad practice in vascular surgery with a special interest in abdominal aortic aneurysm disease, which I think we'll talk a lot about over the next few minutes, and have found it to be a really great sort of challenging field that can really have a lot of benefit on patients' lives.
Well, let's start with the same question that I asked your colleague Dr. Messina. What is aortic aneurysm?
Yeah.
Aortic aneurysm. What is that?
So abdominal aortic aneurysms are a dilation of a normal blood vessel. So the normal largest blood vessel that runs in the body is from the heart, goes around the chest, and then down right along your spine, and then divides to give blood flow to both legs. And that artery is called the aorta. So if you will, it's the biggest pipe bringing the blood down from the heart to then give it off to all the different organs and areas of the body. And an abdominal aortic aneurysm is when you have a weakening of that blood vessel wall and get a dilation. And the definition we use is once it's more twice normal diameter, then it's considered an aneurysm. And the reason this is such a big deal is because the dreaded complication and the natural history of this is for that weakened wall to continue to expand, and then ultimately you can have internal bleeding when that aneurysm ruptures. If you can just imagine a pipe with a weakened wall, eventually it gives way and you just have bleeding outside of the pipe. And, you know, that's responsible for somewhere on the order of about 16,000 deaths per year in the United States, and that makes it the 13th leading cause of death in the United States.
So is it the case that an aneurysm is an aneurysm is an aneurysm, whether it's in the abdominal aortic system, or if it's in the brain, or if it's in the the carotid artery? Is it that goes to the brain?
Mm-hmm.
An aneurysm is an aneurysm. The question is where it occurs and why it occurs.
Exactly right. So every artery can become aneurysmal. Again, that just means a dilation of that artery from a weakened wall, and it seems to happen more often in some arterial distributions than some others. And, you know, for example, some you mentioned, it's relatively common to develop brain aneurysms, which you may have heard of, from blood vessels in the brain. You mentioned the carotid artery, which brings blood flow up to the brain. That can become aneurysmal, although that's quite a bit less common. But one of the most common distributions we see this happen in is the abdominal aorta, which, as you said, is that artery that runs right down the back of the belly.
Isn't it the case that not all that many years ago, that if a person had an aneurysm, or was somehow found to have an aneurysm, because I don't know that many years ago they couldn't even realize that they're aneurysms. I'm guessing that it was pretty much at some juncture a death sentence because it was. Couldn't be surgically repaired or not thought to be able to be surgically repaired?
You know, the treatment of aneurysms has really evolved quite a bit over the last 100 years or so. So I would say that what we would consider sort of modern open surgical treatment, so that means making an incision down the abdomen in order to replace that artery with an artificial artery, really was developed in the 50s and then perfected in the 60s. And has been used since then for repair of aneurysms. But really the biggest change, and perhaps the biggest change in vascular surgery as a whole, is that over the last 15 to 20 years, really starting in 1991, we've now been able to use minimally invasive treatments to fix these aneurysms. So what used to be a very large surgery where you had to spend time in the intensive care unit for several days and maybe 1 to 2 weeks in the hospital to recover has now become a surgery that we can do just with a needle hole into the arteries in the groin and then advance a stent graft or a new tube to replace the aorta from these remote sites using x-rays. And that allows us to get a replacement of the aorta with no incisions, and patients can generally go home the following morning. So it really is a marked change in the way we treat these.
Well, that's just amazing to me. But then again, you stop and think there's a lot of things that can be done minimally invasive. I just had a case where I had an abdominal hernia, navel hernia repaired, and it was done with what used to be, I would imagine, to splay me wide open and put it back together again. Now it was done orthoscopically.
Exactly. Yeah, I think the last 20 years in medicine has really seen a tremendous progress and tremendous change towards more minimally invasive approaches. And, you know, aortic aneurysm repair used to be one of the biggest and potentially most fatal surgeries that were practiced in the United States. But endovascular repair, minimally invasive repair, has allowed that to become a much, much safer operation, and perhaps probably most importantly, just much, much better tolerated in both the short and long term.
Can a person that's walking around feeling normal, not thinking that anything's going on, be having an aneurysm that is on borderline ready to rupture and not even know it?
Yeah, so that's a great question, and it sort of gets to the crux of the challenge with aneurysms, and that is that most aneurysms are completely asymptomatic, so the patient will feel nothing at all until it becomes a ruptured aneurysm, which at that point often is not a salvageable situation. If an aneurysm does go on to rupture, or that wall weakens so much that there is internal bleeding outside of the aorta, about 75% of those patients will die. In other words, 50% won't even make it to the hospital, and then of those that do make it to the hospital, 50% will die when trying to get repaired. So we really, really want to try to repair these in an elective setting before they rupture. But what's challenging is, unlike what Dr. Messina was talking about, where you have clues that there are arterial blockages by leg pain or ulceration on the legs or even gangrene, with an aneurysm, you often don't know you have it until it's too late.
And then at that juncture, he or she could have been walking around with that thing for how long, conceivably, before it finally lets loose?
Yeah, for the most part, aneurysms are not something that forms over, you know, days or weeks. So we're talking 10 to 15 years for aneurysmal degeneration to occur. So the majority of these are actually picked up, number one, by a very astute physical exam by your PCP, where they palpate your abdomen and can feel a large pulsatile mass. So that would be one clue. The other most common way in which these are found is actually what we call incidentally. In other words, you go into the hospital just as you did for a navel hernia, and you know, on the workup for that, perhaps you got a CT scan to look at, you know, the rest of the abdomen and see where that hernia was coming from, and the aneurysm can be picked up in that way. In the United States now, there's a screening program to address this very issue. So any male or female that's 65 and up with a family history of aneurysms or a tobacco history, because that is the single biggest risk factor, is entitled to a screening ultrasound, which is an outpatient test done just with an ultrasound, totally non-invasive, takes about 15-20 minutes to look for an aneurysm, and that is covered by Medicare.
Really? That's very interesting. Very interesting. And you say that smoking is the singular most causal effect for aneurysms?
Exactly. So when you look at risk factors for aneurysm, which is sort of the way in which we think about what contributes to the formation of a disease state, so in this case aneurysms, number one for aneurysmal disease would be smoking, and then it's followed by family history, high blood pressure, and then there's a lot of genetic involvement that we really just don't have a terrific understanding of right now as far as the cause and effect. But certainly, I think as we're learning more about the human genome and the genes involved with disease states, we have a lot more to learn about the genetics involved with abdominal aortic aneurysms.
When an aneurysm is diagnosed, you seem to indicate, at least I understood it to be, that it's almost diagnosed in some cases as a by the way, look what we have here kind of a deal. Is that the case
I think that is true, yeah. So a lot of people will, you know, the last patient I saw for an aneurysm was actually having some back pain from a kidney stone. And on the evaluation of the kidney stone, they found that he also had an abdominal aortic aneurysm, and that's how I came to know him. So that's exactly right. When people are getting examinations for other things, it can often be detected. It can be detected on physical exam. It can be detected by screening with the ultrasound I was talking about if someone has a family history or a smoking history.
Is Is it the case where, that's, for instance, I know when I was, when I had my issue, I had to go back into the hospital because I had some other things post-operative that were causing me to make a tremendous spiral down. And I went in and I had a CT scan. And, of course, they wanted to did a CT scan of my abdomen and the whole nine yards, as I was told, because I don't remember it. That would there have been if there had been an aneurysm there, would they have found it necessarily, or could they still have overlooked it because they were looking for something else? Or would that be amongst the protocol of what they were looking for as well?
Yeah, so, you know, whenever we do radiologic exams, there are protocols to the way in which we look at a radiologic exam, and certainly a part of an abdominal CT scan would be to look at that aorta. So, you know, I can't say for sure because obviously I have not seen your films, but I would feel pretty certain that if you had an abdominal aortic aneurysm, your doctor that was taking care of you would have let you know, because that's something that's not subtle and something that's always checked for.
Well, that's a bit of a relief then.
Mm-hmm.
to know that I may well not be a ticking time bomb with an aortic aneurysm, abdominal aortic aneurysm.
Exactly.
So now, is it still the case where unless we've kind of touched on this, but it's, I don't think that I understood exactly. You understood exactly what I was trying to get to. The percentages of people that are being discovered for the aneurysm with regard to just a normal examination, is that increasing because of greater knowledge in the medical field, or is it just something that they've become more aware of?
Well,
how has that worked out?
I think, you know, aneurysms tend to affect patients that are older, so usually greater than 55 years of age, and then it increases. And that's probably just because you have more time for the aortic wall to weaken over the years of a patient's life and become degenerated and aneurysmal or enlarged. So I think part of the reason, you know, that we tend to see a little more of aneurysmal disease at this time is just because we have an older population, as the population tends to age and people tend to live longer. So you have a higher incidence.
What is it about smoking that causes the aneurysm to be more likely to occur? I mean, what does the actual smoking do to the aortic structure that causes it to be more susceptible?
Yeah, so I think that's a really important question. And interestingly, despite having known for many, many years that tobacco smoke and tobacco usage, specifically smoking, causes aneurysmal degeneration as well as more rapid rates of enlargement, there has really been no firm science that has been able to elucidate what factors are directly causative. So I think that's still a big unknown and something that a lot of research is being directed at.
Besides the smoking, you also mentioned, what was it again? The next after smoking was?
High blood pressure.
High blood pressure. Yep. Is high blood pressure that's controlled with medication, is that the same as high blood pressure that isn't controlled as it relates to an aneurysm?
No, so they're not the same. So the issue with high blood pressure, unlike smoking, is that it's really a purely mechanical force. So you have the wall of the aneurysm, again, using a pipe analogy, the wall of a pipe. And if you have higher blood pressure, you have more force exerted on that arterial wall.
Right.
So if you're able to lower that blood pressure, you can decrease the force. And this isn't something that, you know, matters on maybe a day-to-day basis. In other words, if you have a spike of your blood pressure, that it sort of immediately weakens the aortic wall. This, what we're talking about is really years of high blood pressure. So if someone is well controlled on blood pressure medications, that effect is mitigated. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. It makes perfect sense to me. Is it ever the case where somebody has been diagnosed with an aneurysm, an abdominal aneurysm, and the doctor says, or you say to them, we're going to watch it for a while. We're not going to take action now.
Yeah, so that's very clear. So I mean, that's very common. And to be completely clear, not every aneurysm needs to be fixed. So the risk of rupture is directly related to the size of the aneurysm. And I think that's somewhat intuitive. If you have a much, much larger aneurysm, that wall is significantly weaker, they're at much greater risk of an aneurysm. So very good studies have been done to decide on when is the optimal point at which it makes sense to repair the aneurysm, because, you know, any surgery we do has risks, and you would always want the benefit to outweigh those potential risks. So a normal aorta measures about 2 centimeters, so about 1 inch, and an aneurysm, as I said, is when it's about 150% or double the size. And we don't usually fix aneurysms until they're greater than 5.5 centimeters in diameter. And that's because less than 5.5 centimeters, the risk of rupture is less than 1%. But when you get above 5.5 centimeters, that risk starts to go up significantly.
Is it ever the case where an aneurysm size can be reduced by changing diet, quitting smoking, greater exercise?
Yeah, so there have been a lot of studies that have looked at that, and I think really what we've learned is that you can decrease aneurysm growth, but you can't cause regression of the aneurysm. So, you know, if you're on a statin medication, which has been shown to be beneficial, certainly in peripheral artery disease, it's actually also been shown to reduce the rate of enlargement of abdominal aortic aneurysms. Similarly, if you're able to control blood pressure well, as we just talked about, that can reduce the rate. And then the single most important is if someone does smoke, to stop smoking, because that will decrease the rate of growth. But there's no way, there's no medicines available, and there's no treatment available at this time that can cause an aneurysm to actually decrease in size.
So it's not like letting the air out of a balloon, the balloon gets smaller. That doesn't happen.
The problem is there's no air in the balloon, there's blood in the balloon.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Good. Great point. So now the physical activity surgically of repairing an aneurysm, are you putting something inside the vein? Sliding something up inside the existing artery, rather, and then that is the extent of the surgical procedure.
So there are really kind of two paradigms for repair, which we kind of alluded to a little earlier, and that is there is the historical treatment, which that's been used since the 50s and 60s, which is an open repair, pretty big operation, involves a incision under general anesthesia, then going to the intensive care unit, usually being in the hospital for a week or two. And then there's the minimally invasive repair. So the open repair, you actually cut out the aneurysm and replace it with a plastic tube. On minimally invasive repair, we're able to bring a stent graft just from a needle puncture in the groin artery all the way up through the artery, thread it up the artery to where the aneurysm is. And then that stent graft is deployed so that it expands, and it becomes the tube in which all the blood flows. And the aneurysm is then excluded from the circulation. So this reinforced stent graft that was advanced through the artery becomes the new conduit or aorta for the blood flow to go.
Now, when I was reading these medical terms here, that you were performed the first implantation of an investigational branched endovascular graft. What is that?
So that's a mouthful, huh?
Yeah, it is.
So when we do an endovascular repair of an aneurysm, if you can imagine this tube coming up from inside the aneurysm or within the artery, it's a fabric-lined tube. So the advantage is that all the blood flow ends up going through this fabric-lined tube. But if there's a branch coming off of the aneurysm, that becomes a real problem because now that's not getting any blood flow either. It's hard without a picture, but hopefully that makes some degree of sense because you're excluding all blood flow to the aneurysm. So what these newer technologies, which involved branched endografts, allow you to do is to have little branches that come off of this tube that then provide the blood flow to these critical organs. So if the aneurysm is at the level of, let's say, one of the arteries that goes to the kidney, you wouldn't want to just cover that with a normal stent graft because then you'd have no blood flow to that kidney. So what we're able to do is use a stent graft that has an additional branch, another tube that brings blood flow directly to that kidney.
It's amazing. And can that be done orthoscopically or through the groin vein?
You bet. Yep. So that's all done. The term we usually use is endovascular as opposed to something like laparoscopic or orthoscopic. But exactly. So it's brought, this whole system is brought up through the artery from the groin artery.
How many of these branches can you run off of one graft? That's number one question, I guess. And how many places in the arterial system in the abdomen is it necessary, or would it be necessary conceivably, to have those various additional branches?
So that's a complicated question, and it's really evolving in real time right now. And we're just really in the United States starting to develop this technology, this branch graft technology. Only a few centers are really doing quite a bit of this. And basically, the goal is ultimately to be able to treat all types of aortic pathology with these types of branch grafts. So you need to be able to accommodate any branch coming off of the aorta. For example, you mentioned the carotid artery earlier going off to the brain.
Yes.
The renal arteries going to the kidneys. Maybe most importantly, the superior mesenteric artery that brings all the artery to the brings all the blood flow to the intestines. So there are really a number of critical vessels that we're trying to learn ways in which we can provide minimally invasive repair that still preserves blood flow to these critical branches.
Well, we're coming down to the short rows here, Doctor. I'll ask you the same questions I asked your colleague. What is it that we haven't said that needs to be said about this topic that you're discussing?
Yeah, I mean, I think probably the most important thing is that, you know, we as patients and we as physicians need to have an increased awareness of abdominal aortic aneurysms. I think a lot of patients are not aware that they're entitled to a free screening when they're 65 and they enter the Medicare system. And I think that, you know, a gentle reminder to your PCP that you're up for a free screening is very appropriate, because this ultrasound can very easily, in a non-invasive way, identify a patient that could have a treatment that could potentially save their life.
Very good information. All good information. Well, I tell you, Doctor, it's been a very insightful hour as far as I'm concerned, talking to you, the two of you, and I do appreciate your taking time to be with me as well. And congratulations on all you've accomplished in your specialty of aortic aneurysms. I think it's just wonderful that you're on board for a little while with me to have this information out there so people can reference it later if they're not listening currently. So thanks again for being my guest. I do appreciate it.
Yeah. Well, Pete, thank you very much for having us. Have a good day.
Thank you, and you do the same.
Bye-bye.
Bye now. This has been an interesting show. I mean, it's been an hour worth of conversation with two cardiovascular surgeons, people that really know their stuff and know how to handle various problems and diseases of the circulatory system. And I've learned some things. And I'm also grateful to know that I've probably been looked at for an abdominal aortic aneurysm, didn't even know it. And if they'd have found it, they'd have certainly had to tell me about it. So that's kind of good to know. Well, this has been the Boomer the Babe Show, where we try to bring you good conversation every day, bring a good conversation to the world. I think we did that today. And everybody, enjoy your weekend. Take a little time to check out your arteries, I guess, or whatever the case might be, and maybe re-listen to this show or hear this show for the first time if you stumble across it. And I hope it could possibly do some good for somebody and maybe even save a life. Who's to know? Thanks again for listening. Have a great weekend, everybody, and we'll talk to you again next week. Take care now.
to the Boomer and the Babe Show, where we bring interesting conversations to the world. Be sure to follow us on Twitter, where we tweet as Boomer and Babe, and on Facebook as PetePeters47. As always, you can friend us on Blog Talk Radio or sign up for our newsletter at boomerandthebabe.com. Email us at host@boomerthebabe.com with any of your comments. Remember, at 50, you're just getting started.